This program is brought to you by PrideNZ.com.
So my name is Peter Lineham, and I've just concluded a period of 7 years as chair of Auckland Community Church. And I've been involved in Auckland Community Church for 13 years now, which is not anything like the whole life of the church, of course. But like a lot of people, I became involved in Auckland Community Church at the point when my church community was growing extremely suspicious of me, and I was being edged out. I was later to be kicked out, but I was originally edged out, and I needed somewhere safe to go. And I remember the first time I went to Metropolitan Community Church, which was then meeting in Pitt Street Methodist Church. And I went there, and while the people were very friendly, there were some unusual factors. And so the next week I went to Auckland Community Church, felt very at home, and have been going every week ever since, basically.
When you say suspicions, with your previous church, what were they saying or doing?
So I belonged to an Open Brethren Church. So this is a fundamentalist or conservative church, although within the Brethren spectrum, one of the most open churches around. And they were nervous about any person with even a gay identity, because that was defiling. And they were anxious that even the identity would lead to sexual involvement. And they were most concerned at the risk of that. And at a very early stage, I went to a function at St. Luke's Remuera, I was in a photograph in Express. Now, it was in a church building. But this photograph was passed on from somebody in the Brethren movement to the elders at Eden, at the Brethren Church. Of which I had just finished being chair of it, you understand. And this photograph was produced as evidence that I was dangerous property. I pointed out I was at a church service, but that didn't seem to make a great deal of difference. So that was the kind of risk involved, that there's a fair measure of high alarm that anybody would mingle with gay people. Now, there were a lot of exceptions to that individually, but as an organisation, that was their stance.
What was that like for you personally, knowing that somebody's actually, trying to kind of oust you from a church?
It's an extraordinarily difficult experience. It's a tangled and confusing experience. It was made much worse because, for reasons that I do not fully understand, a young man, newly married man in the church, made an extraordinary accusation that I'd tried to kiss him at Massey University. And this was a complete fabrication. But of course, that made my position even more untenable. And so the church, which always did things very properly, sort of set up an investigating committee. So it was a very uncomfortable position for me. What I found was that I'd set off on my bicycle to go to church, and most of the time I couldn't make it there. I just couldn't get there. And if I did get there, I would just sit and basically cry through the services. So that was the sort of thing that was going on. And this is me, a fairly stable, sensible sort of person. So it was a difficult scene, and I had great support from people within that church, but that didn't prevent the structure. And finally, but this was somewhat later, finally, when Kevin appeared on the scene, I was given a letter which said, "We'd like you to change churches, and we'd like to send a message to the church you're going to saying that you're a wonderful person and we totally support you, but we're unable to give you any pastoral support." So it was a kind of excommunication, and that's okay. I mean, they did it in a very nice way. So I changed to Ponsonby Baptist and to All Saints Church in the morning, because I'm a pretty churchy person. But I'd already been involved for a long time by that stage in Auckland Community Church.
Where does your involvement with the church in general come from?
So I'm raised, you have to understand the Brethren. The Brethren is a world. it's not religion, it's your world. So if you're raised as I was in a Brethren family in a small country community, and all your relations and the church, that is on the whole your life. And you live in that world, and you step outside it to some extent, but you're confident in stepping outside that you've got a secure base from which you can step outside it. And I mean, I had fine parents who, in the end, although there was a few changes of church along the way, fine supportive churches that were very happy for me to step outside it on the basis that it was a secure place inside. But clearly, you know, there are some limits around that, and that's just the way it is.
So what was it like, I mean, if your whole life is based around this, to then suddenly not have it there, or to have people actually kind of trying to push you away?
Oh, I mean, this is a traumatic experience. Very, very, very difficult. You understand that I was also one of the best-known figures in the evangelical world at the time. So I was on the board of the Bible College of New Zealand, of Scripture Union New Zealand, of Tertiary Students Christian Fellowship, etc., a tier fund. And they all asked me to leave their boards. I offered my resignation and they enthusiastically accepted it. So, I mean, this was all part of the process. Funnily enough, I was doing some research over in the Laidlaw College Library, reading the old copies of Challenge magazine, which is the evangelical or fundamentalist magazine. And I discovered I'd written a letter defending gay issues to the magazine. Not being a regular reader of this magazine, I wasn't aware of an astonishing string of letters that followed. I was trying to investigate my current book on Destiny Church, but I found I was investigating the way that I was excluded, basically. See, that's not... understand that, I mean, I was a high-profile person, so that was sort of more evident, maybe, than for most. But for anybody in a Catholic or an evangelical or conservative Christian background, that's the experience they'll have. And there's an enormous feeling of being orphaned, you know, and really losing your place in the world. And it's a very curious situation to be in.
During times of things like gay liberation in the 70s, the homosexual law reform in the 80s, did that kind of stuff have impact on you and your relationship with the Brethren?
Yes, but I kept a low profile in that period. I mean, I watched in Christchurch and in Palmerston North, these things were not quite as prominent, shall we say, as they were in Auckland. And I played a quiet role, shall we say, in these circumstances. I was actually overseas in the year of law reform and on a sabbatical leave. So I was almost totally unaware of some of those things going on. Well, I mean, I was aware from a distance. But when I came back, it was all over and done and dusted. So I was away from mid-1985 to mid-1986, you see.
Did you ever have any internal conflict between the kind of religious elements or your religious life and homosexuality?
Oh, well, of course, there was an awful lot to sort out. But I mean, I've been sorting it out for my whole life, you know, you understand. And that's often true of a lot of gay people with religious backgrounds, that there's a constant debate. I didn't, you know, go through the experience that a lot of my friends seem to have gone through of self-hatred. I'm intrigued that I basically accepted who I was. Sometimes found a curious set of sort of non-contentious words for it. You know, I wasn't inclined to get married, or, you know, sort of strange things like this, afterwards I discovered that everybody knew my cover, but I didn't know that at the time, you know. And I think they were quite content as long as you didn't use words that were sort of dangerous. And I think that's the way it goes. That's the curious ambiguity of sometimes churches, that certain words are dangerous. And if you can choose other words, they're not dangerous. Very strange.
Can you give me some examples?
Oh, I think around, if you take the whole issue of marriage breakups and the like, similarly, you know, so long as you can somehow be the good party in a marriage breakup, or so long as in one sense or another you can show due humility about what has happened, people are surprisingly willing to accommodate that. And I think the reason for that is that typically evangelical and fundamentalist churches, a bit like Catholic churches, take a fairly ordinary sample of people. You know, they're not particularly an educated group. They're average communities who are very keen to attract people to come to their services. And so they come with lots and lots of staff. And what they want is for people not to cause trouble by their past. So as long as you've sorted your past out, it's okay to have a past. But it's not okay if it's a present, you see. And that's the complexity of the situation.
What was it like then to go to a church that had kind of lots of openly gay people in it?
Well, I mean, I can recall very vividly the first Sunday, because strangely enough, I had been leading Auckland Community Church meets in the evening. Most churches don't meet in the evening, so it was kind of convenient I could escape without anybody sort of knowing I was there. And the thing was, when I got there that Sunday night, I immediately recognized about four people, including some with a Brethren connection, and one who'd even been in the service where I'd actually been leading the service that Sunday morning in the church. And I felt like bright lights were on me and tape recorders were on me and I was exposed. And this was incredibly dangerous. And then I realized, well, but then that must be true of them as well. And that was a really quite surreal moment in some ways, when I realized that a lot of people there were kind of there because you could get away with being there and you might well have a double life. I've never been comfortable with a double life, you understand. So, I mean, I was not frightened to tell people I was going to Auckland Community Church. They weren't comfortable to hear it. So that was quite interesting. Even today, you know, at Auckland Community Church, we get people who make it as far as the door, but won't come in and sit down because they're very, very nervous of being seen. So that's the kind of extent to which there can be powerful coercive pressures.
So tell me about that first service. How was it for you?
Oh, I mean, I think the service was pretty much like all Auckland Community Church services, not exactly exciting. I mean, Auckland Community Church does a kind of pseudo-Anglican service. And, I mean, to my mind, it's not how any decent religious service should be at all. I mean, I would like something much more lively and engaging. I would like sermons that people find interesting and that they touch on hot issues and that they sort of go inside your being. But a good deal of Auckland Community Church is saying a liturgy, listening to a somewhat, you know, one of these Anglican-style sermons, which is usually, you know, 15 minutes long, and usually says nothing at all, very much. And I found this tedious in the extreme. But then we went, as we always do at Auckland Community Church, into a stood in a circle for communion. And after you receive communion, you're embraced by the person who's given you communion, and the person who's come to you prays for you. And at that moment, I realized there was something very deeply affirming, that they were affirming me for me and accepting me from the very outset. And I found that, as many people have found at Auckland Community Church, that's a very, very moving part of the service. And so that was all right. And I didn't go back to, I mean, I went back to the other churches in the morning, but this immediately became important to me.
Can you describe the congregation? What's the makeup?
The Grin Community Church congregation changes quite a lot as circumstances develop. But it's typically people who, I mean, predominantly for a start, they're single. This is quite an interesting aspect to Auckland Community Church. Quite a lot of them, like a lot of churches, are older, so they're over 50. And quite a lot of them have known each other for a long, long time, and there's a friendship and support and community. So that's one group. When people become couples, I mean, by and large, there's only two or three couples where the couples come regularly to church. Like, my partner cannot stand Auckland Community Church, and he will come on occasions, but he can do a very funny takeoff of, ah, man, and he just goes into hysterics of laughter, whereas he quite enjoys Ponsonby Baptist, which from his Chinese background is kind of more familiar and he's more comfortable with that. But he does this very funny thing where he says, holy, 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 and he thinks that's just so funny. And so he finds liturgy absurd. And I think, to my mind, that's part of the problem of Auckland Community Church. It's into a warp, which it does need to get out of in some ways. And I think one of the brilliant things about Vaughan as the new chair is that he is going to try and nudge us out of that. I tried for 7 years and found it very difficult. We've made a little bit of progress, not enough. Now, so there's that aspect. Then secondly, a bit more about the community. Then we always have these people who come in and need Auckland Community Church for what you might call their transition into identifying themselves as GLBT people. And the church can help them immensely. Now, typically, those people, we don't see them for a long time. You know, we help them for, say, 3 or 4 months. And then they're ready to stand on their own, they find a partner, they become more confident in going to the clubs or something like that. And the religion that's been used to help them suppress their identity now isn't necessary to them. And that's fine. I mean, because I think sometimes religion keeps people from discovering themselves. I mean, it shouldn't do that. But sometimes that's all right, because they need to move on. So many a person in that context has come and visited me here in my house and has wanted to talk over the Bible verses that attack gay people. And we've sat and talked and gone through it, because what I am very anxious about is what you might call the suicide threat for the person who feels that they've committed the unforgivable sin. They've had sex with a person of the same gender, and they're going to be cursed, and something vile is going to happen to them, and they loathe themselves, and they want to hear, are these verses going to destroy me? You know, am I going to be bashed by God, who is so angry with me at the moment, and yet I need this, I want this, I found something about myself that I needed to find out, and I knew it, but I didn't know what to do with it. And quite a lot of young people are in that context. And I go through the verses with them, and I suggest there's other ways to look at these verses, and I suggest that we're not bound up by Old Testament rules, which were given for a totally different purpose. And after a while, that gets through to them, and they become more confident in themselves. And if there's a real rich faith in them, they'll find a church which will accept them as they are, or they'll stay at Auckland Community Church. But quite a lot of them are young, and they'll break through that, and that's fine. And there's been some wonderful stories about people who've made a fantastic transition, and I keep up with them on and off, but they're not anywhere near Auckland Community Church now, and they probably laugh a bit about Auckland Community Church. And when they get a partner, I mean, Sunday night's far too good to give up. You know, that's their last chance to get ready for the week, so it doesn't work for them either. So I think the third thing is, culturally, in terms of relevance, you know, we're still in the hymn singing mode. And I do think this is, I mean, who sings hymns these days? I mean, the churches that I went to were far more culturally on the wavelength of young people. They knew what music young people liked, and they produced their own Christian version of that music. And I think, see, part of the absurdity of this whole situation is, I reckon, for example, I mean, I'm not Pentecostal, but I do think the Pentecostal style of worship is quite gay, you know. And I think, you know, a lot of gay people love dancing and they love getting into it and things like that. And this is why a lot of them remain undercover in Pentecostal churches, because it's totally their scene. And I had one man who came to see me here, and he went to a certain well-known Pentecostal church in town. And I talked and talked to him, and I thought I'd got through. And then I received an email from him saying, please remove all details about me from your phone. That's all right, but you see, it wasn't all right for him, because nothing had changed. He was going out having casual sex in the bogs. You know, I mean, that was his way of finding the escape. So what was good about that? And, I mean, this is the tragic situation that you've got to deal with who you are. And Auckland Community Church stands for, really part of the whole pride thing of the LGBT community, that there is nothing to be ashamed of. Here is where we should be. And here, this LGBT community needs us. Because discovering that you're gay does not solve all your problems. You know? You've still got that loneliness, or the bit when your partner leaves you, or the bit when things are tough and you're on your own. And you've still got the kind of issues of faith still nagging around inside. And we say the two's got to be brought together. Got a bit carried away there. But
so you came to the Auckland Community Church in the early 2000s?
Yeah, that's right. In 2000, yes.
Prior to that, do you know the history
of... I do know the history of Auckland Community Church, because I'm a historian. I'm kind of fascinated by this story, and one day I'm going to write it up. And I've sort of started a couple of times and given up. But there is quite a good history on our website by one of our previous members who's gone overseas now. And, I mean, it is a fascinating story, because this is before law reform it all begins. So it begins... A bit about St. Matthew's will make sense of this. St. Matthew's was always the kind of risque church. But it was a down-in-the-dumps, run-down church in the days when nobody lived in the central city. And so, and before the advent of the casino. So there was talk of bulldozing St. Matthew's down, that beautiful church. But the thing was, it's Omeru stone, and the limestone had the... seeped with water, and it was sort of in real risk of falling down. And there was a vicar brought in from Australia who started this kind of radical line. St. Matthew's had once been a very strong and impassioned low church centre of Auckland, which fancied itself as the Auckland Cathedral, but they built a cathedral somewhere else. And so that was about that time when all this was going on. And so... he was on the side of causes. And remember, this was the 70s and early 80s, when causes were all around and people were fighting the Rainbow Warrior. You know, there was all this stuff going on, the nuclear-free Pacific. And so St. Matthew's was engaged in that. And they started noticing that a group of gay men had been coming along quite quietly to the service. And so an invitation went out. I think a request went in saying, would you be prepared for us to get together? And so they asked for one of the clergy at St. Matthew's to meet with them on a weekly basis for a little kind of group. They could sit and talk. And this group began in the early 80s. So... slowly, this little group was nurtured into shape. And as it slowly began to form and hold these events, I think down in the basement of St. Matthew's, as I understand it, and it was meeting regularly in that period, then came about discussion about whether they could begin to hold a service. And really, this was extraordinarily courageous of the church to authorize that on Sunday nights in the main church at St. Matthew's, they would hold a GLBT service sponsored by the church itself, but open to any of the GLBT people of Auckland. Well, you can imagine at that stage when, I mean, what was there? There were these famous gay nightclubs, but not much on Sunday night. So you had, you know, old drag queens, and you had a very colourful assortment of people turning up and coming along to the service, and everybody was nervous about police raids. But in fact, I don't think there was ever much. This was at the stage when, I mean, what would they accuse people of? They were just meeting for a church service. So, but of course, there was a lot of criticism from surrounding churches who wanted nothing to do with it. But then came law reform. And so from the time of law reform, it was much more easy to hold these public services. And there began to be discussions with a number of key people, Kim Benton and the like, that perhaps St. Matthew's could actually designate someone as the kind of pastor of this church. So they, with the Vicar of St. Matthew's part of it, they began setting up a little council to run these services. And then they heard of Metropolitan Community Church in the States. See, this is interesting. Troy Perry had come out. I was reading a book about this the other day. Troy Perry came out and started the Metropolitan Community Church even before Stonewall. So what date is Stonewall? Oh, 80... No. 69. I think he wrote in 69 and it was 70 that Stonewall or something like that. But it was a year beforehand. So MCC by this stage had developed quite a reputation. So they invited and made contact with MCC, which by this stage had a presence in Australia. So MCC said it was willing to send, in effect, a missionary to look after this church community. And so that brought about the next stage in the story of gay Christians at worship in Auckland. So the group, a pastor was sent from the States, and he came out, and services seemed to continue as normal. And then they discovered quite a sharp divergency. I mean, MCC is a separate denomination. It ordains its own clergy. It isn't, you know, I mean, it you run by the MCC rules. Now, these folk, of course, were a kind of branch of an Anglican church, and they were pulling in all the sympathetic clergy, and there were a lot of sympathetic clergy from around the town who loved coming to Auckland Community Church because it was their statement of support of the queer community. So there were rumblings. And then the concerned people, I think, went to the vestry at St. Matthew's. And St. Matthew's was quite concerned to hear that, in effect, they were actually sponsoring a separatist church community. So there was a showdown in 1979, I think was the date. So the MCC folk, with their very lovely pastor, moved to Pitt Street Methodist. And the group that remained behind organised themselves as Auckland Community Church. And that was the beginning of it in 1980. And so that church was, with the cooperation of ministers throughout Auckland and money fed in by the Presbyterians, this is a nice irony when you think of how the Presbyterians have ended up today, as well as support from the Anglican Church and resolutions passed in the Auckland Synod of support, and with one of the Presbyterian ministers seconded to be part-time pastor of the community, reverted to a form of worship where it would always be clergy from a variety of backgrounds. There was no denomination that you belonged to. You didn't give up your old identity. And the service was kind of eclectically like any conservative but liberal church community. And that's the beginnings of the Auckland Community Church story. Now, to be fair to MCC, they carried on meeting at Pitt Street. And I saw them in Pitt Street in 2000. But they've subsequently moved to the Friends Meeting House and are much, much smaller than they were. But during, for many long years, Doug McGee, former Salvation Army officer, was their pastor and part-time pastor. And we've always had good and friendly relationships and often held one combined service a year. As I said, they're much smaller today, and we've tended to grow or remain stable in size. They're always changing over, of course, for the reasons I said. So that's a bit of an interesting story.
So are you also saying that prior to Auckland Community Church, well, and also the MCC part as well, in the late 70s, there was no other kind of out gay worship group?
Yeah, precisely that. Precisely that. Yeah. But of course, you will appreciate that this was the day, these were the days when huge raging debates were taking place on theology, and there were liberal churches in all the denominations. So St. David's in Kuiper Pass Road, Pitt Street Methodist, St. Matthew's were the three, along with the Unitarians, the four maybe big, visible liberal churches that made a point of being welcoming to gay people, but absolutely no sort of public things. And the early pastors, even of Auckland Community Church, were pretty quiet about their own sexuality because they needed to be in good standing with their respective bishops and presbyteries and the like. And they, you know, those matters would have been rather concerning to the presbyteries. It was one thing to support poor gay Christians, you know, but another thing to, how far did you go in support? Until law reform, that was the situation.
And at the time of law reform, did the church actively promote?
Oh, you need to understand that Auckland Community Church was one of the cornerstones of the gay world. And, I mean, of course, it wasn't everybody's cup of tea. And there were plenty of violently anti-Christian gay people. I mean, there still are. I don't know if you read that extraordinary opinion piece in the Herald on Friday. And these sorts of things happen where Christian is everything associated with homophobia in this. And there were always people who thought that. But it's very, very interesting in terms of the kind of service sector of the gay community. It's really, for a long time, consisted of groups like Outline, and it's in its previous name, the AIDS Foundation, and so Auckland Community Church has always been one of those things. And see, on World AIDS Day, it's to St. Matthew's that everybody comes for this big combined kind of memorial, and we give up our service for that Sunday night and welcome in a vast crowd of people who wouldn't probably come near us at other times. And, you know, we're very much well known within the older parts of the gay community, less so the lesbian community. There's an interesting difference in this respect, in that for many, I mean, I can't speak for women, but it strikes me that many lesbian women who perhaps, if they chose, it's not so unusual for two women to live together. So if they come out as lesbian, this is a radical and political step. And it may be much more associated with a denouncing of Christianity than for gay men, strangely enough. I mean, that would take a bit more of untangling and a bit more research to work that one out. But so we've always had a much larger proportion of men than women in our service. There's always been some women in our service. And there's always, I mean, historically, there were some very, very lovely people from St. Matthew's who were straight, but who came regularly to the community and just were there and were supportive and very encouraging and very loving, you know, and that was wonderful for the community. A lovely couple, Heck and Peggy, were very familiar in the history of the church for many, many years. And then there were other personalities who could be themselves at Auckland Community Church, but they had another existence as well. And so there was the famous case of Doc Martin, who was a very familiar former retired evangelical youth worker who was very deeply involved in the church from his retirement onwards, but would, for family reasons, that was kept to himself. And I think there probably are still people like that.
And you were saying that the congregation is growing?
Yes, it is quite striking that, I mean, all churches have ups and downs, and a gay church has particular ups and downs and ebbs and flows. But it did reach a pretty low state in the early 2000s. And I think part of the factor was it had just got too introverted, you know, and there is a wee aspect of gay sensibility which kind of adores high church prancing about, and, I mean, it can reach the point of silliness. And especially as young people have no connection with this. And there was a real turnaround, and this we owe an enormous amount to one of our fine great members, and that's the Reverend Bob Scott. And Bob Scott is a remarkable man who was outrageously gay as an Anglican minister for many years, and used to shock, because you understand those, there was the time when gay people were so outrageous. And when he was in Auckland, he was a notable figure in the Anglican Church, and he shocked them to the core. But this was the time when Paul Reeves was the Archbishop and was very, very sympathetic to gay people. And so Archbishop Paul was totally protective and horrified by Bob at the same time. And then Bob went off to the World Council of Churches in Geneva, where he played a very interesting role there. And then he came back in his retirement to Auckland and didn't like the state of the church. And Bob can say what he thinks and did. And we sorted ourselves out. It was very good for us. So, you know, you've got that aspect. And I mean, I have noticed that some of the service organizations of the gay community anyway have tended to decline. And I think one of the reasons for this is there isn't so strong a gay community as there used to be. You know, once upon a time, the gay community was nurtured in adversity. And there were these great moments of pride in the hero parades when the gay community defied the world, and the Auckland Community Church donned angel wings and pranced down in slightly lewd, slightly fun, slightly outrageous, singing hymns in a state of semi-undress, you know, down the street, challenging and shocking people. But the whole hero parade was a bit like that, you know, and there was this nurtured sense of community identity and adversity. Now, of course, it's now a very comfortable thing to be gay. And I mean, some of us have reflected that the recent Pride March is a bit of an indication, because, you know, the Pride March went on agreement that it would be a nice, acceptable for families to attend. No nudity, no, you know, nothing to shock, everything respectable and nice. And it was, and it was delightful fun, you know? But in such circumstances, to be honest, the gay world is now just a market, you know, like a lot of communities in New Zealand, of course, but the gay community, strikingly so, is a market that people target because the gay dollar is great to try to get people to spend. And it's, especially for young gay people, it's just a great big consumer game where, you know, you go around and prance and preen yourself, and it's as empty and vacuous as they come in some ways. And so quite a number of those warm, caring, community-focused organisations have found it very hard because there's not many volunteers coming forward to do things. And I think we had to turn a corner and say we really can't afford just to stick within ourselves. You've got to become outward looking and say, we need to speak to people by whatever means to remind them that we're here and to say that you need us. You will need us. And we're going to be here and we're going to serve you and we're going to try and make a difference. So that's our, I think, our key philosophy. Not done perfectly.
However, since 2000, I mean, there have been times where it has been uncomfortable. I'm thinking of things like civil unions and...
True.
Like when Destiny Church was yes. marching against civil unions. And I guess, how did the Auckland Community Church react to something like Destiny?
Okay, so, I mean, without any doubt, this was great for Auckland Community Church. Because that gave us a sense that we have got to be out in the face of this. So, in fact, Bob Scott went down to see Brian Tamaki and to tell him what it was like when they got that kind of slander, you know, thrown up in the face of it. And others were very engaged. And on civil unions, we were extremely involved. And when the then Archbishop of the Anglican Church, Hui Avirko, said he wished there was a world without gays, we wrote a public letter to Archbishop Virko when all the rest of the church was saying, be nice, you know, he's just a doddery old man. But that's not acceptable behaviour for a church to act like this. It's appalling. And so when, especially for the sake of those for whom it would become words too dangerous, so we needed to speak. And of course, one of the concerning features, and maybe this is perhaps why a gay church can remain a bit more vigorous than the regular community, is although in the regular community, gays are now very accepted and indeed even desired to some extent, this isn't entirely true in the general church. There are plenty of churches, and indeed, sometimes I think there are more churches that are quite uncomfortable with gay people, at least in their public statements. Of course, they'll often say other things to your face, but their actions, their public actions, show that they're nervous, that the congregations are conservative. It's interesting that young people in ordinary churches have a different outlook, seem to be reasonably comfortable, because they've been helped by the public school, you know, system and the like, which has done great things for helping people to think differently. But, you know, the Presbyterian Church, which was once very supportive, is now, you know, basically has said that any gay ministers, no new gay ministers will be allowed. The Anglican Church has a moratorium, which means that anybody in a relationship will not be considered for ministry in the Anglican Church, with the exception of one diocese and not in Auckland. So the result is that in terms of currently, gay ministers are getting older and older. So, you know, we struggle a bit to find ministers. On the other hand, we're nurturing in our community plenty of good people who can do lots of stuff. And I think we just, there's some challenges ahead of us. But that's all right. Maybe we need those challenges to sort of make us think differently.
On a personal level, how did civil unions affect you and things like the Destiny Church marches?
Oh, well, I mean, I think that was actually really, really beneficial, because you can't remain silent in the face of this kind of junk. And it was absolutely essential that I, you know, mark my different standing point, my different point of view. And so I led the submission that Auckland Community Church made for the Civil Unions Bill. And as I said then, and I think it's highly relevant to the marriage legislation now. Would you prefer gay people to have as much casual sex as they possibly can? You don't want stable relationships. You prefer, you know, bursts of sin followed by bouts of guilt. Is that your idea of healthy society? Surely, on your own logic, you should want stable relationships, because they're healthier than people sleeping around and picking up whatever. And you know, that was a point that I have made strongly in a number of contexts. And the church, I think, has, you know, much as I have been very much nurtured by that sense of weak. we mustn't be too nice. You know, there is a bit of a risk of being too nice. I mean, I'm a naturally nice person, so I don't like being in your face. But there's plenty of people in our church that say to us, look, don't let them away with it. And I think that's a good point.
It's also really interesting that a couple of years ago, the St. Matthew and the City billboards started making headlines in terms of just being very provocative. Talk to me about that. How did they come about?
Of course, there's a very funny aspect, Gareth, to this whole story of the St. Matthew's billboards, because St. Matthew's actual morning congregation is not that large. You know, I mean, the days of liberal Christianity having a big following are, you know, well and truly behind us now. And so St. Matthew's is helped by being in such a very prominent place and being gloriously restored with the help of the casino and, you know, lots of aspects like that. And so it's in a key position, and it's a very strange combination, because all around now St. Matthew's are apartment blocks filled with overseas students who are not particularly interested in religion. And then there's still the City Mission next door with the homeless and the needy, many of whom come into our services on Sunday night to keep warm, and have some really weird views about us. And there's often a bit of demarcation disputes going on there, and we work hard on it. But it's an uncomfortable relationship at points. For St. Matthew's, it gives them identity, especially while the Anglican Church remains still very coy about the whole issue. So in this context where people are a bit uncomfortable and a bit uncertain, St. Matthew's can wave a pro-gay flag and get a sensational international reputation, which indeed was linked to a magazine, an online magazine, which they put a lot of money into, and that was profiled them. So that it helped to profile them. But of course, the funny thing about all of this is very, very few of the evening congregation go to St. Matthew's in the morning. I think a couple of people. And the reason for this, in my view, is quite odd. Effectively, gay Christians tend to have come from conservative backgrounds. They're not terribly likely to be comfortable with some aspects of St. Matthew's service. So we have an amusing situation, well, you can call it amusing, where the type of Christianity of Auckland Community Church is not really the same type as St. Matthew's, but St. Matthew's is very generous to us, and in some ways our congregation, in terms of our core congregation, is probably much the same size as St. Matthew's. And we'll always do what we can to support and encourage. And we do a couple of services together a year. But we'd be much more orthodox in our faith than St. Matthew's. We'd share a bit of high prancing around, you know, stuff, if you're so inclined, but not on every Sunday. And at times we'd try our bit at doing a semi-Pentecostal style service, which St. Matthew's rolls their eyes at. And I mean, I campaigned for a while with St. Matthew's that we could have a big, big PowerPoint screen so that we could, you know, do visual stuff. But you see, St. Matthew's is much committed to a beautiful building. And so that certainly wouldn't suit their style. But I mean, our identity in St. Matthew's, it's kind of interesting. It's a bit like a tango. You know, I mean, we're stuck together. We're very unalike, and we're glorious partners.
Civil unions and now marriage equality is going through Parliament as we speak. And I'm wondering, what is the feeling within the congregation of Auckland Community Church in terms of marriage equality?
There has been a certain amount of discussion, because some of us from a slightly older generation, especially the women, recall that age when marriage was seen as a decrepit institution which was completely completely the last thing that you'd ever want. And there's others, and I'm a little bit this my own way, who says, I don't mind if marriage remains the heterosexual thing. We could do our, you know, we want to celebrate our unions, and we can call them what we want to, but does it really matter? So there was a big, big discussion to try and sort all this out. And in the end, we realized that we have to fight for marriage equality together because of the way in which it's being defended. See, the way in which it's being defended is, I mean, all, it leaves us with no choice. It's being claimed that this is the essence of Christianity. Well, since when did Christianity control marriage? That's not on. It's complete misnomer. Marriages existed long before Christianity. Secondly, marriage as this sort of heterosexual love nest, this is all very well, but this kind of marriage has only existed for the last 200 years. I mean, before that, they were always arranged marriages, and there was often a bit on the side, you know. So, and what about polygamy? You can't tell me that this narrowly conceived, love-based, heterosexual marriage, which seems to have a pretty large measure of divorce built into it, you know, is something that is somehow belongs to the fabric of society as an unchanged, permanent building block of society. I mean, that's just ridiculous. So we had to challenge that. So we agree that it's our obligation to defend. I mean, besides, civil unions is quite clearly a cop-out. You know, I mean, it was a nice thing to have as a first step, and it's interesting that the debate over civil unions was vastly more painful than the debate over marriage, which is quite surprising. And I think it's a measure of a number of things that have shifted since then, but let's not go into that. I mean, but it would make a great analysis to work that one out. So it seemed very, very clear to us, especially also as the language that people are using for civil unions has clearly shifted into, they're calling them marriages anyway. So, you know, well, since a marriage is a civil union. I mean, why can't the state get honest? And so, therefore, we decided, although we might all take different attitudes towards the traditional institution of marriage, it seemed to us clear that we should fight together for the change in the scope of marriage, and really to let civil unions drop away because it's neither here nor there in some ways. So that's the logic.
Why do you think there has been such a change between when you look at how much anti-feeling there was towards civil unions as opposed to marriage equality now, which seems to be going through pretty happily?
Yes. I'd say two things. Firstly, I think it's something about the way churches work that they do a last-ditch mentality. And they threw everything into the battle against civil unions. And it was actually a very close-run thing. And it was, you know, there was high tensions and massive public engagement. And they lost. And the sky did not, you know, fall in as they predicted. And the defense of marriage, I mean, for a start, it has been so ridiculous. Here you get Family First and the like defending civil unions. I mean, the hypocrisy of it, this phenomenal aspect of life. I mean, who can throw their heart into fighting this battle if you have to do it by defending civil unions? I mean, this is corrupt. This is utterly corrupt. So I think there was the nonsense of that. And I think, secondly, an awful lot of churches are pragmatists and say, well, it's pretty clear we're going to lose this one. And thirdly, I think, you know, we are clearly part of an international discussion in which some very significant changes have happened in Britain and the like. And the phasing is just a bit different, so that New Zealand is now behind. And, of course, there is one key aspect which is really, really interesting. It's come in a national government. Not a national government bill, of course, but The civil unions legislation came at a point where an awful lot of conservative churches were just waiting for a fight against the Labour government. So as I see it, the national government is a bit like the conservative churches. It knew that it was going to lose. This national government is entirely pragmatic. If it had been Don Brash's government, of course, that's quite different. Although, I mean, Don Brash can play, you know, plays his own games as he wants to. That's another story. But the opposition in 2004 and 5 was quite clearly polemical as part of an attack on the Labour government as being morally suspect. And so it was part of a general campaign in which you've got to recall that many churches subscribe to very right-wing philosophies. And at that stage, remember, there was a George Bush government installed, and it was reading an apocalyptic scenario about the evil world in which gay people were part of that evil scenario. The simple fact is that the textbook has changed a bit since then, and the national government that's, you know, hardly got full of original ideas and decides everything in terms of trade and advantage like that, chooses not to spoil for this fight. How ironical that John Key should appear as the happy PM turning up at the big gay out and smiling happily and saying he's going to support it and he'll speak to his MPs. This was the man who voted against it, of course. But then John Key is a politician. I mean, he's nothing more than a politician. And that's what we're seeing. I think all those factors feed into this.
What about in terms of things like Destiny Church? Why don't you think they are chasing after this bill?
There's a specific reason for Destiny Church. They threw everything into that struggle because actually it was a practice. They wanted to make their name for what they thought was going to be the moment they're going to get elected in 2005. So in 2004, this was all part of a rhetoric that was going on to play it up. But you see, once you're left without a strong, determined leader like that, you come to the usual chaos of churches who can never put their act together because there's 100 different causes. And so the only clear voice has been the Catholic Church. But because it's the Catholic Church giving that voice, I mean, it's not exactly a commanding moral presence in New Zealand today, the Catholic Church. And I think those factors have been quite obvious. So while the evangelical community has said some things and there's been petitions, there's been nothing by way of public protest. And that's very, very interesting, I think. It's a real statement that the church has actually accepted defeat. And it said, I mean, I think it's quite a significant admission. It's saying that we are not in the centre of New Zealand anymore. Now, we've all known that, really. But I think they have now recognised that, and that's a very significant admission.
You're currently writing a book on Destiny Church, and I'm wondering, and you've done interviews with members and Bishop Tamaki as well, do they regret what they did with civil unions?
No. But they always say they were misunderstood. And as I say, they chose causes not because they were that important to them as causes. They chose causes because of the mileage they'd get out of them. And they would fly kites. And if a kite would fly, then they'd fly it. And if it didn't work, they'd pull it down and go and look for something else. I mean, it's very interesting, for example, that Tamaki, when he began his television program back in the year 2000, was going to do, you know, women should not be in positions of leadership. And that was the case that was being presented. And that was how TV New Zealand, you know, with both the leader of the opposition and the prime minister being women, this was a pretty outrageous thing to say. And Television New Zealand said, you mustn't do that. And so they were forced to pull back on that. And it was fabulous for them because they had their audience made and they didn't need to pay for any advertising of it, you see. It was just perfect. So that's an important aspect of the way that that strong fundamentalist line works, is it kind of likes being the bad boy. I think, yet all the time, the ridiculous thing about this was that Hana Tamaki always was a very significant player in Destiny Church, and Destiny had pioneered in the Pentecostal world the use of women pastors, as always, husband-wife teams, of course. And, I mean, that paradox, they wore these strange paradoxes. Destiny's from a working-class Māori background where women have to work. So, I mean, what were they going on about? Well, I think they were just testing the wind, and it worked. So it was very pragmatic, I think.
Looking back over your time with the church, with the churches you've been involved with, what do you think it's given you?
Oh, well, of course, faith, to my mind, always integrates your personality and your wholeness, enables you to deal with your black spots, and to also know a little bit more confidently how to relate to people and how to really do community which is wholesome and healthy and enjoyable. It shouldn't be too precious, of course, and that's often a weakness of community in our present world where we divide so much into kind of the way we do community. Auckland Community Church can be a bit odd in that respect, but there we are, a little bit twee, if you like. And, I mean, it is quite amusing because in the old days, I think, Auckland Community Church was an alternative to the clubs, and the people who just were too old or too uncomfortable in the club scene could safely meet people at the church. And I sometimes think that's still what we do. You know, and I've got a range of people I keep saying, you'll be all right. Somebody will come along. You know, it will work out. And I've watched it happen in some cases. But as, you know, everybody knows, sometimes you do find somebody and sometimes you don't. And I mean, that's one of those mysteries of life, isn't it? So I think for me, I mean, this is the interesting thing. I'm involved in a mixed but pro-gay church, two of them actually, because I'm crazy, you know. And I mean, I'm a specialist in religious history, so I need to, you know, have a wide sample, as well as Auckland Community Church. And I mean, Auckland Community Church doesn't totally do it for me, because I love children being around and I love the sort of the fun of a whole variety of different people, and I like helping little old ladies. And Ponsonby Baptist has a enormous work with the mentally ill and has a housing trust that houses 200 of them. So, you know, that's a pretty busy community, a small community, but a, you know, very interesting community of its own. So it's full of interesting and vital life, and I think that's how church should be. And in a way, that's great, you know. But then in another sort of way, in a funny sort of way, I'm still brethren deep down. I'm still a person for whom there's a totalness about community, a totality of world, and I kind of get it through three active church communities, each with their own different aspect. Also because, to me, faith nurtures the inner life. I'm a kind of very outward person, but there is an inner life, and you need to nurture that, and you need a church. And the Anglican style suits me a bit too, because it's got that stillness and slowness that is part of the essence of, you know, full life, I think. And Auckland Community Church, in a way, for me, I'm an evangelist, really. You know, I mean, I kind of want to help people wherever I can. And we need Auckland Community Church because we've still got to help people. And imperfect though it may be, it's a wonderful place for touching people. And you may get one chance to help them, but you can make a fantastic difference. So that's how it works for me.